You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this lunchtime lecture. I'm the Director of Fellowship at the RSA. And I'm delighted to welcome our special guest speaker, Mark Payne. So Mark is co-founder and president of the leading innovation consultancy, Fahrenheit 212. Not Fahrenheit 212, as he just told me. He has spearheaded innovation projects for some of the world's most iconic companies, including the likes of Coca-Cola, American Express, and Samsung. Mark has now distilled this experience into a new book, How to Kill a Unicorn. As we all know, every business and organisation is looking to innovate and to introduce something transformative and see it make an impact in the world. But the fact is that many innovation drives produce ideas and visions that might dazzle and amaze, but can only work in some imaginary world. So what's the secret to creating innovative products and services that have a viable chance at real-world impact, and will not just survive, but thrive on the challenging journey to market? So we really couldn't have a more qualified speaker to help us tackle that question today. So without further ado, please welcome Mark Payne. Thank you. Thanks.
So thanks so much for coming, all of you, giving up a valuable hour. I consider all of us drawn to the conversation around innovation to be kindred souls, in a way. We're sort of the ledge walkers, willing to step out into a realm of uncertainty with a very real risk of falling to the sidewalk in a big mess. And today's talk is very much about how to make the big leap without going splat on the sidewalk, as it were. So again, thanks for the invitation. The human mind is a spectacular repository of images, associations, and connotations that build up over time and sort of idle in the neurons, waiting for the right piece of stimulus to set them firing. And in this absurdly dynamic age, which we have to think of as a golden age of innovation, this word on the wall behind me has grown as loaded with meaning, I think, as any other you might put up against it. The things that innovation evokes are both completely timeless and absolutely timely. Fire to the wheel, to coffee by the pod, the designer's soft clay and the shiny object, the mating dance of art, science, and business, better mousetraps, soaring share prices, and the relentless forward march of human endeavor. You're hard-pressed to find any one word that can kind of unleash that much in those minds of ours. But for all of these meanings that innovation has long enjoyed, there's one in particular that has really taken hold over the last 10 years that I think will change the innovation conversation in the next 10 years, and that meaning is growth. When I first started dabbling in innovation a couple decades ago, there was no pressure on it. Innovation could be the random, once-a-decade lightning strike, the big thing that accidentally went right, and everybody was happy. There were lots of easy ways, more chess-like, predictable moves to grow a business. But the world's grown saturated and complicated, and today we see innovation being synonymous with growth. The companies that aren't innovating aren't growing. With that comes a new pressure. Now, pressure's good. Pressure brings out the best in us to invent new ways around things, and we should all invite that. And the importance of innovation now is a very exciting thing, but it means there's a challenge that we need to step up to. So on the one hand, we can say there's never been a better time to be an innovator. The tools, resources, and talent being thrown at us. We opened Fahrenheit in London a few months ago. We've got our team here, and one of them, Sandra here, came to us with a PhD in innovation out of Oxford. And we have no idea what they taught her there, but she's incredible. These things were never there when we started, right? So all of these resources and skills. My son's science fair, he's 14 years old. I walked in the other day and there was a 3D printer sitting in the 8th grade science fair. And I'm freaking out. Oh my God, there's a 3D printer in an 8th grade science fair. And of course the kids are like, yeah, whatever, of course. Think about what's going to happen with all these tools moving forward. So never a more exciting time to be an innovator. But in many ways, never a tougher time, okay? We are seeing a number of forces coalescing to make us work harder to achieve innovation success. Barriers to entry have come down across categories. Retailers have consolidated. Consumers, no offense to the millennials in the room, but you should hear the nasty things big companies say about you. You guys change brands like you change socks, and it's hard to know you've got a business that sticks today. These forces of disintermediation, should a client of ours like Citibank be worried about what other big banks are doing or what one of you guys are cooking up in a back room somewhere that could make their whole model go away? Open innovation, an incredibly exciting thing. I can throw my problem out to the marketplace and it will answer it for me, but your competitor can do exactly the same thing. So where's the durable advantage in that? And then we have the speed with which new ideas are taking hold, which is incredibly exciting if you're on the startup end of the food chain, but really scary if you're an incumbent. Why is Mark Zuckerberg freaked out and writing huge checks for all kinds of speculative things? Because he knows what happened to MySpace, right? And we could be displaced more quickly than we ever could. Now, all of these things would make it a challenging climate where innovators would have to work harder. But there's a multiplier that's been in play that's making them all even bigger issues. And that is that the innovation models in wide use today fail. They don't fail occasionally. They don't fail quite often. They fail almost all the time. The reality is, when a group of smart people like you are commissioned by a company to answer a growth challenge with a big number on the wall and handed a blank piece of paper, the odds of that making the leap from the post-it note to the street to the balance sheet are less than 1 in 10. Now, when innovation didn't have any urgency, that was okay. The once-in-a-while lightning strike, was all you hoped for. But now that it means growth, that's an unacceptable kind of success rate moving forward. No other mission-critical business practice can afford that kind of low success rate. Now, to hear the conversation around innovation, you hear that that failure is the natural, normal, and noble outcome of attempts at new stuff. But in starting Fahrenheit 212, we're crazy or naive enough to say, well, shouldn't we really just challenge that assumption? We thought a bit about the Wright brothers, and before they came along, you would have thought the natural outcome of human attempts at flight is broken bones and scattered gizmos all over the pasture. And of course, post the Wright brothers, we look and say it was a flaw in the method we were using to fly. It wasn't the nature of flying that was the problem. So is failure the nature of innovation, or is it a flaw of method? Is the question that we built our business around. So challenging the nobility and naturalness of projects misfiring. So we set up Fahrenheit 212 as a mission-based business with one simple goal, to transform the odds of innovation success. Now, what that means to up the odds is different depending on where you sit in the innovation food chain. If you're a CEO, it means innovation can deliver predictable growth. Those random lightning strikes are toxic to a CEO. You want, consistent growth over time. If you're a CFO, it's that your bets on innovation are delivering better returns than doing things like buying other companies or investing in operations. And if you're a project owner in innovation, you actually don't care if only 1 out of 10 projects succeed. You just really care about being the one that does get it right. So this has been kind of our obsession and curiosity over time. What's come of it is an innovation consultancy in New York and London. Do a lot of work with Fortune 500 companies, a lot of work with PE portfolio companies, and also some interesting emerging businesses. What we do is create innovation strategies and turn them into stuff, whether it's new products, new services, new experiences, new systems. And we're outcome-obsessed as an organization, all about getting to the tangible outcome rather than saying, oh, we learned a lot. We had a great journey. Look at all these post-it notes. It was spectacular. What's come of it as well is we've built over $3 billion in innovation revenue for some companies you've heard of. It's been a great privilege to work with them, but also a great learning environment for us. What's important to our mission of figuring out what works and what doesn't is the breadth of these organizations. So great companies in tech, great companies in FMCG, in financial services, in retail, in hospitality, which has allowed us to spot the patterns of what works and doesn't work in these radically different situations and extrapolate a code for how to make it work a lot more often. What we do for these organizations is basically six buckets. Diagnose where we think growth can come from. Do the exploratory work to tease out the unmet needs in the marketplace. Turn that into strategy, and then in turn turn that into new products brought to life vividly through design. The whole point of writing this book was really to give folks an easier way to learn things that we learned the very hard way. We struggled, we failed, we misfired, and continued to restlessly ask why, not just say that's normal. So if you pick up a book today, you'll get these things in an easier way. But if there's one big thing to take away about how to tip the odds from this 1 in 10 long shot nature of every innovation undertaking to turning it into something with a high probability of success, which is meaning for you personally and for your business, it's to realize that innovation at its heart is a two-sided problem. What do we mean by that? If you think about the way an innovation funnel works in most organizations, you kind of have three phases going on. There's a strategy function at the front end. Maybe it's corporate strategy people. Maybe it's a McKinsey or a management consultancy applying analytics to look at data and say, okay, here's where there appears to be a growth opportunity from a very logical standpoint. We get to the middle of the funnel, and here we have the design function where we're applying empathy and getting deep consumer insight, teasing out unmet needs, and marrying them up with incredible product ideas. Then we get to the back end of the funnel where the filtering happens and ideas are killed off and the strong survive. Now, a few things jumped out to us in looking at this. Aside from the numbers game, where so many things go in and so few make it out, there's one powerful characteristic about the stuff that does make it out. The only stuff that makes it out are what we call two-sided solutions. What do we mean by that? On the one hand, we have the needs of the consumer. Okay, they need a better life, better experiences, better functionality, all that great Maslow stuff, security, comfort, pleasure, right? We know any innovation in a consumer market has to deliver to those things. What does the business need? These are not surprising things either. A business needs to know an innovation fits strategically with where they want to go, fits their operations, it's smart choices of where to play, how am I going to make it work, how am I going to make money, how am I going to manage risk and reward. So both of these things seem obvious, but what struck us a few years into the journey is a kind of profound and simple realization. These two sets of needs have nothing to do with each other. What do I mean? If I tease out an amazing unmet consumer need and come up with an incredible product to satisfy it, but if I trip and fall on any of these things on the other side of the ledger, that idea will never make it out to the street, will never touch a single consumer's life. Conversely, if I come up with the amazing analytical case pointing to here's where your growth lies, but I can't tease out that unmet consumer need and turn it into a compelling product, that strategy will never touch the balance sheet either. Now, in hindsight, back to this hypothesis, is there a methodology flaw that explains why 9 out of 10 things fail? It's this obvious gap. There is no innovation model, we realized, built to deliver to two sides of the equation. You've got analytical models and you've got design-led models, but either without the other is of no real value. So the method that emerged is what we call two-sided innovation, or we sometimes shorthand it as money and magic, which is letting form follow a function. Working from day one to say our job is to create a two-sided solution that is going to work for the consumer and the business, and every step of the journey calibrated toward doing that. Now, there's an interesting kind of meta theme behind this that I would call energizing tensions, where you take seemingly opposite things and crash them together, and amazing new things come out of it. Any fans of Breaking Bad in the house? It wrecked like 3 months for me. I was up all night when I got into the series late and just kept going back to back. You've got the two Walts, right? You've got the meek, geeky science teacher Walt, who gave away a $1 billion idea in his 20s. Turned into this badass, drug kingpin, whacking guys all over the place, Walt, right? And the tension of those two characters coexisting in the same person is ridiculously compelling. If we look at Apple, the tension between technology and humanity, those were completely opposite things until Apple said, no, we're going to use humanity to give technology a point of view and use technology to abet human creativity and possibility. So harnessing that tension created something powerful. And even democracy. Before democracy came along, to be free and governed were seen as opposite things. You can't be both. Along comes democracy, and you see how freedom and governance actually propel one another when they're shoved together. Freedom makes governance more effective and accountable, and an orderly society allows freedom to be meaningful. So innovation has its own version of that, and we shorthand this as money and magic. Money, the analytical task of solving for what a business needs, and magic, the creative pursuit of new possibilities and consumer solutions. So the capabilities it takes to do this, we started out entirely on the right side, and we're creating beautiful ideas that were going off to die because they weren't built to be right for the organizations we were creating them for. And we realized we needed to build out this whole set of analytical capabilities and bolt them together in a methodology capable of doing big things over and over. If happiness is a nice warm metaphor, think of it this way. You need to thread two needles with one move of one thread. Now, the interesting thing is if you're only looking at one of those two needles, whether it's the business or the consumer realities, it's actually very easy to get through that hoop. You can come from any angle you like. But the probability that the angle you take is going to go through that second thing that needs to be solved for is immensely low unless you're looking at the orientation of both of those things from the beginning. So thinking that innovation is a two-sided problem, what do we then do? Well, you want to create what we would call two-sided solutions. Innovations purpose-built to be great for the consumer and amazing businesses. Pull some examples from the street to help illustrate the point. The Mini Cooper's fabulous because for consumers, it brought new personality, fun, and self-expression to the small car experience at a level it never really had before. But as a business, the thing that makes it so powerful is has nothing to do with that. It's that where other automotive companies decide that to cover a big slice of the market, you need lots and lots of models with lots and lots of manufacturing lines, lots and lots of labor forces and tooling costs. They've built this from the beginning to be the most nimble and adaptable single model that could run down a production line. So what made it incredible for the consumer and as a business were very different things. With the Coca-Cola company, we were happy to collaborate in something called the Freestyle system, which satisfies consumers' desire for an ever-expanding array of beverage options while solving a huge pain point of the business that in quick-service restaurants, consumers wanting hundreds of different beverage choices could never be satisfied without building bigger restaurants, and they weren't going to do that. So this amazing machine, which uses a technology akin to ink printers or dialysis machines, allows them to synthesize 100 different beverage options in exactly the same footprint as the old four or five spout soda fountains we've all lived with for years. So it's quite a brilliant two-sided solution. I'll pull a case from our work to show a little bit more about how these two-sided solutions come to life. We got a really interesting call from Samsung, an amazing company of scale that's mind-blowing. They are 19% of the GDP of the 15th largest economy in the world. I mean, that scale is just absolutely daunting. Their biggest profit center was in LCD components, which they sell on to Sony or anybody who needs to build something with an LCD in it. Margins were plummeting in all the current markets where LCD was playing. We had a challenge to try to open entirely new markets where LCD could become a higher margin technology. The where to play at the beginning of this project, well, we knew what it couldn't be. It couldn't be a TV, a phone, or a computing device, which left the entire vastness of the rest of human life as the addressable space. We had to strategically go figure out what we wanted to do. In the strategy phase, the hardcore analytics come in. We needed to move over 600,000 screens. They had to be 10 inches or bigger in concentrated markets, launchable within 24 months with no new technology to propel it. In the solutions phase, we turn strategy into stuff, specific ideas very deeply explored. We identified 9 or 10 addressable markets, none of which LCD was a meaningful force in to date. apply serious commercial filtering to those possibilities? Is this market big enough? Are there big problems we can solve in this market? Filter them on a scale we call big, fast, doable, which is a critical tool when you want stuff to work. Understanding, is this a great idea for 20 years from now, or is this something that can be delivered within the kind of time horizon? And what jumped out of this was a very unexpected opportunity in the world's vending machines. There are 30 million of these things. We would only need to penetrate 5% to hit our commercial goals. These machines are physically big. If you need screens bigger than 10 inches, well, you've got a big host for them. 70% are owned by just three companies. They have electricity, which is a really good thing because an LCD screen without electricity isn't of great value. No obvious technical hurdles. The big thing that's interesting here is this was not using LCD to create a better vending machine that was going to sell a couple more things, although these machines absolutely do, but transforming the role it would play in the business of the companies who use them, turning it into a means of connection with the consumer on the street, not just a dumb distribution point. Some insight on how this money and magic two-sided alchemy actually works. This began with an observation at a pizza joint. There were a bunch of teenagers there kind of mugging and mocking a vending machine, saying, "Oh, you stupid dinosaur, you know, what are you doing here?" And it got someone on our magic team thinking, "Well, gee, you know, if they're mocking it, there's probably a reason." A phone call goes back to our money team, and in 24 hours they come back with a 360-degree commercial assessment of the vending industry and realize it's absolutely huge and deeply broken and deeply in need of this kind of innovation. And we got to realizing about that comment, the consumer comment about, you know, you dumb machine, they were actually completely dumb as a business system. There were all these disconnected assets sitting all over the place with no connection, no synergy, no system, really. So we zigzag back and forth between understanding consumer pain points, the pain points of the guys who make the machines, technologies and UX design, the view of these machines through consumer packaged goods eyes, the functionality we wanted to have, the tech spec, the economic model for it, et cetera. So what came of this? This has become an amazing new platform for Samsung and for anyone who has used vending. Coca-Cola picked up on it first and announced it at the Beijing Olympics, and they're now deploying these in pretty large scale around the world. Unilever came in and did a brilliant thing over here, where they added a layer of facial recognition software on top of the platform, so if your smile was big enough, you'd get a free ice cream. Kraft came in and overlaid mood recognition software, where they would recommend a meal suggestion based on what they could see in your face, although you couldn't resist saying, well, couldn't they just use a body scan and say, may we suggest a salad? Other businesses that would have never touched vending with a 10-foot pole suddenly jumped into it. L'Oreal has a machine over near where Fashion Week happens in New York. The machine is a full-length mirror on the outside. As the woman stands in front of it on her way to work, it's scanning her, reading her skin tones, her kind of hairstyle, and her outfit, and suggesting out of the 400 SKUs in the machine, here are the two or three that you might really want to pick up here. So it's an absolute transformation. I think there's a lesson. If you want to enter a business you're not in, you'll probably fail. If you set out to transform that business, your odds of success become a lot greater. So fast forward, what's come of this two-sided model, which we stumbled and struggled and experimented our way to. We're now seeing that where those industry-wide success rates are maybe 1 in 10 projects delivering something, in a given year, we're seeing between 70 and 80% of the projects we touch deliver real stuff into the innovation pipelines and into the balance sheets of the businesses that are sponsoring these undertakings. Do we still misfire? Absolutely. Sometimes you do things that are just ahead of their time. But for all innovators out there, let's just start with this simple thing of understand that it's a two-sided problem. It can make a world of difference. So that's the 20-minute version. The curl up with a glass of wine version is there that goes into greater depth on these stories and much more. But I think at this point we can open up for Q&A.
Thank you. Thank you. That was really interesting. I like your description at the beginning that innovation is the mating dance of art, science, and business. I might have to use that. One thing that's quite interesting is the way you've tried to almost turn innovation into a process or kind of pin it down and you get the old kind of theory of innovation is a team, an innovation team sitting there coming up with the innovations. And I wondered, to what extent do you think it is about the right people who are just brilliant and innovative, and to what extent actually it is just getting the process right?
So it's all of the above. In fact, we describe it as the three M's internally. It is method, it is model, and it is minds. And you can't separate any of those from the other pieces and have it still work. Again, in our early days, we were just hurling creativity at these innovation challenges, unguided by strategic rigor, unguided by concern with, you know, how things actually get made and done, and realize that you get to goosebumps on a Friday afternoon and headaches and silence on a Monday morning when the client realizes, I can't actually do anything with this. So it's been the alchemy of those three things of the method, the model, and the people you put into it that's certainly made the difference for us, at least.
And one thing I was interested when I noticed your list of clients, which is pretty impressive, but I couldn't see one from the public sector or even the charities. And I was wondering whether it's, seemingly they haven't got the money to pay you because you're quite expensive. But is there something around, because the public sector is notoriously bad at innovation, and do you think there is something inherent in the way the public sector is set up that it's bad at innovation, or they just haven't got the money to pay you?
Sure. So we're very excited about that space. In fact, we've got a whole team dedicated now to building out social innovation as a space for us. And in fact, we've got a couple of live proposals for work with government organizations. To be honest, we didn't want to go far and wide until we knew we had a model that was going to work. I mean, we're so outcome focused that now that we've, you know, pedigreed the model in this cluster of, you know, a pretty diverse spectrum of industries, but not every space. We're excited to unleash that more broadly because we think the model applies. Part of what's different when you think about social innovation is that two-sided model. You've probably actually got about five or six different sides that you need to solve for. The same principles apply. We've got to solve for future generations if it's a sustainability initiative. We've got to solve for the needs of government and taxpayer if it's a government initiative, as well as all the other, you know, external constituents that are involved. So the model applies, and we're pursuing that now with great excitement.
And one more question just before I open it up, and this is probably a really mean question, but I couldn't help answering with all your success stories. Has there been an epic failure? Has there been some fantastic thing that just didn't work? Or what's been the biggest?
There's been a long list, and a lot of ugly kids that were kicked off the farm. But one great example of what happened when it was just creativity applied. We were working with a huge consumer goods company. And we were working in male grooming as the space where we wanted to play. And we came up with an idea that a clean-shaven guy like yourself, not much good for me, but a clean-shaven guy would love, which was a shaving cream that would actually retard the growth of your beard. You think about it, like, wow, I can shave and, like, go days without shaving again. And you think, wow, what an amazing idea for the consumer. Thinking about it from the business perspective, it was an absolute disaster. There was no technology capable of doing that. Shame about that. This company had no brands to play with in male grooming. They had, you'd have to ask the question, are you going to enter a market and shrink it? Is that a great growth strategy? You know, because people would presumably need a lot less of this stuff. So here was a great idea for consumers that was dead on arrival as a business proposition. And, you know, that was one of a dozen of those where we were creating great ideas that were going off to die because they just made no commercial sense. And that helped, you know, catalyze where we got.
Yeah, interesting. If it ever does come about, well, thank you for it. That sounds great, yeah. I have to say. Do we have any questions from the audience? Yes.
Hi, Beatrice Freeman, M Crypto. I would be very interested to hear, what do you do if it is the equivalent of 1950s and you have invented the equivalent of seat belts? We invented the simplest encryption of email on the market with the benefits of protecting confidentiality, protecting your reputation, and preventing identity theft in confidential emails. We've got the Software of the Year award for it. Mm. We are not making much money. what to do when you are so much ahead of the market, and we actually invented it 11 years ago. What do you do when you are so much ahead of the market that actually a consumer doesn't know that they need it, that they want it, and how do you turn it into money? Thank you.
It's a great question. We face it a lot. I mean, we've done our share of things that were simply a day early or a decade early, and that's going to happen. I think the couple key things about that type of case. You've got to figure out where the willingness to pay resides if you want to make a lot of money. There are a lot of interesting analogous spaces like the automated home of the future, you know, that have created all this noise. But consumers' willingness to pay is limited to very few functions in the automated home. You know, how much are they going to pay to make their windows go up and down when they could just go, you know, open the window? So I think interrogating where the willingness to pay resides in that market is a big deal. That's a B2B type play, I would imagine, because you want email carriers to embed the technology. So you've got to understand the economic value to them. Are they able to create premium pricing in their services, et cetera, et cetera? And if that route doesn't work, where you can't make it an attractive proposition that's going to generate payment from somebody, then you need regulation to intervene. I mean, what made the seatbelt happen wasn't consumers wanting it. It was a regulatory intervention to say this is the way it's going to be done. So try to become the standard.
What was your personal path in becoming an innovator? Presumably at school when they said, what do you want to do? You didn't say, I wanted to go into innovation. So how did you get to where you are now?
So I think if I look back, and, you know, hindsight is always far more sensible than the moment you're living in, I was kind of tugged in two directions. I was studying economics, had the good fortune to spend a year at the LSE over here, which was fantastic. But paying for my beer by doing graphic design and writing songs and playing in bands and stuff. So there was always kind of this two-sided fascination. And in retrospect, innovation was just a really good fit with that. This mating dance of creativity and business is fundamental to it. But I think in the moment where I decided to just do nothing else, I was drawn in equal measure by the incredible electric excitement that innovation represents, that alchemy of human imagination and coming up with the thing no one's thought of, married up with the fact that innovation practice is kind of a train wreck. You know, it was completely broken, not delivering what businesses needed, and the urgency was getting greater and greater. So it was equal parts of excitement about the way what innovation is and about how big the need was for a better way to do it.
So you said you employed someone who's now got a PhD in innovation. I was wondering, to what extent do you think a course in innovation is helpful as opposed to other life experiences?
I think so much more is known about this space today that I think a course in innovation today could be incredibly helpful. Now, there's no substitute for doing, right? I'm amazed how many books are written about innovation and theories that just make it sound so dry and pedestrian and awful. Like, I'd never want to do that. But when you get into the room and feel the lightning strike and feel the struggle and the striving, you know, that's when the value of that education becomes real. But, you know, in our experience, the people coming out from strong programs are amazing. And we've hired a lot of folks out of UK innovation programs that are just doing incredible things.
Hi, Tony Rook, fellow of the RSA. I just wondered how you get over, particularly with big business, sometimes you have to innovate in a model that's very successful. How do you get them to realize that they're going to actually have to cannibalize their business model to actually go forward? And I'm thinking of people like Polaroid that failed to do this, Kodak failed to do this, and to some extent, some of the mobile phone equipment makers.
That is a fantastic question. It's a real issue. The good news is there is such a growing body of industries who thought they were immune to being disrupted by other people. We do a lot of work with big hotel companies, and, you know, Airbnb has rocked their world to a level you could never imagine. That makes the conversations a lot easier about, you know, of course we have to, you know, leap to the future before, you know, the business performance is telling us we need to. But it's a real issue. I think you have to understand what their time horizon is, I think, is a really big factor. Selling a company a vision that's a 20-year-out vision when they're asking for what's going to go in my pipeline in 18 months, we did a lot of that early on and realized that's just pointless. But I think that the more of those examples grow, look at what Uber has done, look at what Airbnb has done, look at what's happening in financial services, it's getting easier to convince businesses that it's innovate and disrupt your own, or someone will do it to you.
Do you sort of see a difference between those companies that really try to innovate and those companies that just look around and try and buy all the other innovations up before anyone else does?
Well, there's a healthy amount of trying that any business needs to have. I think businesses that just lean back and wait to buy stuff off the shelf, they pay a great premium. Coke, for instance, went out and bought Vitamin Water, which was, a fortified fruity water, which they had all the capability in the world to create. They paid $4.3 billion for that business. And it was a right strategic move for them to get healthier things into their portfolio. But you realize the price of not having that, innovation engine firing yourself. So I think any healthy business is going to be failing 30% of the time trying big things, generating a healthy flow of kind of moderately disruptive stuff, and having a good flow of the closer in stuff in order to deliver sustained growth, which is at the end of the day the real point that we're after.
We have a question from Twitter which says, "What do you do when you come up with an innovation that is good for humankind but has no commercial value?"
Figure out a path to market for it. You goodwill alone won't make something happen. You'd be amazed, though, if you really apply your imagination and commercial savvy to it, that you can define the person or organization or entity that can make that happen. Obviously, the sweet spot is where you create something that is of obvious value to an organization and of obvious value to the public good. I think if you really apply yourself, you can find that entity. Just don't stop if it's not obvious.
I very much enjoyed your talk. I would observe there are probably quite a lot of practices who are working in a not dissimilar way to you, like native design and plan in London, IDEO, who've been doing a lot of work in this area for a long time and so on. And I don't think the landscape's quite as kind of parched as you imply. But I'm interested in your point about if you don't plan to disrupt your industry, don't plan to make a major change, then you're likely to fail, which I very much sympathise with. And Clayton Christensen, as the last speaker alluded to, has set out that paradox very clearly. And I do wonder actually whether the kind of transformations you're talking about are really that transformative. If you look at, you said it's a golden age of innovation today, I think if we went back 100 years, we'd say that was a golden age of innovation. It was the time at which, transportation was being transformed, radio and television were being invented, pharmaceuticals and healthcare were being transformed, and so on. And really today, the only game in town is digital networked communication, which is very powerful, but itself is 50, 60 years old as an innovation. And the kind of things you're doing. I love the Samsung example. I'd love to know how much, value you created for Samsung in that. But in the great scheme of things, it still seems like a relatively small innovation. And, I wonder if actually the challenge we have is really the factor of risk, which often stymies innovation through regulation, which you rightly laud as well. So say GMOs, which seems to me like an amazing invention, innovation. Became clear from an article in the FT recently that Green Lobby has basically stymied any regulation that would allow GMOs to be to flourish in Europe. And maybe that's the right thing, I don't know. But the fear that we have about the future, in a way, seems to be an overwhelming factor in limiting innovation. And is that something you've observed? And is that something that we can address? Risk is the biggest deal in town. You didn't talk about it once. If we don't deal with our perception of risk and the willingness of our governments to be risk-averse and precautionary, we will never innovate in the scale that we need to and you advocate.
Sure. So I touched on risk in the two-sided problem and what are the needs that need to be solved on both sides. And risk, intelligent management of risk is absolutely fundamental to solving the business or organizational side of any innovation. What often kills kills innovators and their ambitions early on is putting all their energy into bringing to life the upside of their innovation and paying no attention to the what the risks are and how they can be managed. And applying creativity to the management of those things is so fundamental to how you go and do it. Now, there are a number of other ways that you can manage this. You need companies to be willing to take a greater level of risk on their more disruptive long-term innovation plays, and proportionally less risk on the closer-in things that just plug into existing models. And a healthy innovation portfolio for any company has a mix of high-risk bets capable of bringing high returns, moderately risky bets capable of delivering moderate returns, and fairly low-risk bets capable of delivering reliable returns. And usually it's having that portfolio right that creates the permission for those higher-risk things to have a chance to succeed. If all a company's doing is high-risk stuff, of course their CEO is going to put his head in the sand and say, I just can't go there, because reliable growth is a CEO's job at the end of the day.
Thank you. Very, very interesting talk. My name's Chris David. But it does strike me that your model is one that's predominantly targeted at larger existing enterprises that are, as you just said, dealing with risk, dealing with the cannibalization of existing activities. So could you say a little bit about how your model and your thinking applies to the, you know, the grassroots entrepreneur, the single person or group that's starting out, in other words, a business startup?
So the short answer is that the principles absolutely apply of saying, looking at this idea that you're working on at midnight in your garage and saying, you know, okay, what's the big win for the user or consumer or customer I'm aiming this at, and what's the big win for this as a business? And just even beginning to get that question into the consideration set, a lot of entrepreneurs have told me it has just changed the way they think about what they're already doing. The factors on the business side are quite different, of course, because as a startup, you don't have any assets to worry about. You don't have to worry about operational fit. You do have to worry about risk, because it may be the retirement fund that's at risk, or your Uncle Phil's money, whatever. You don't want to, you know, upset Uncle Phil. But the basic framework of saying I've got to figure out how this works on both sides is fundamentally relevant and important in those situations. Now, the one exception to it seems to be a lot of tech startups, where they say, hey, if you build an audience, the business will follow. The interesting thing when you think about that, though, is that there's already an implicit business model in the background, which is you're going to sell those eyeballs of your users to advertisers or marketers in some way or other. So in a way, the business model is already there. You just haven't figured out the specifics of it. But that's unique, I think, to tech plays that are built on building lots and lots of users. But the basic framework absolutely applies. At least that's the feedback that I've gotten from so many startup entrepreneurs. We get asked by startups a lot to help them out, and I share all the principles and, you know, drink beer and give lots of free advice. But, you know, I also tell them, look, go be a startup, you know. Hiring a consulting firm is the antithesis of being a startup. So go make your mistakes and learn, but just think about the two-sided problem and maybe it'll help.
Do you see a difference in mentality between the people who start a startup and the big businesses in terms of their appetite for risk, take on board feedback, think of the two sides of the problem? Because I think the two sides, I think, for example, is interesting. I wondered whether the organizational politics would play even more heavily than it would otherwise, because you're trying to bring in the business side early. You don't have that in a startup.
Sure. So of course, there's a difference. But the best innovators in big companies are entrepreneurial in the way they go about it. You know, they're working on how can I hack the system to make this thing happen, and they know there are going to be disbelievers who can't see the vision when the thing isn't fully baked and proven. So, you know, the best innovation cultures in big companies have found a way to carve out, let those innovative people operate the way they need to operate, and they know they've got to reconnect into the system. You know, they've got to do the connect the space capsule to the to the orbiter somehow, but letting them, you know, be their entrepreneurial selves has been a fundamental thing. You know, as for the difference with startups, we were a startup ourselves, and you know, we almost fell over a couple times, and we, you know, absolutely have kept that streak alive, and you know, look for that in potential clients. Frankly, you know, there's a certain look in the eye where you can tell they're serious about making something happen, not just doing it because it's in their job description. So,
just returning to the title of the talk, Innovate and Survive. Just an interesting question. Is your model applicable in all cases? So, for example, if you've got a mature business, say a manufacturing business, which was in decline, are you confident enough in your model to be able to say, yes, we can find an innovative solution to return growth? Or do you find yourself occasionally having to say, sorry, you're done for?
It'd be a sad thing if I said we couldn't take on any problem. You know, do we get it right every time? You know, of course not. You know, innovation is a humbling thing. You know, getting to a much higher success rate doesn't mean you can, you know, work magic and solve everything. But there is something about our approach that is incredibly helpful to that, which is too many innovators ignore the existing asset base of a business. They get fascinated with future states that have no real connection to what exists today. And what we've learned the hard way and found incredible power in is looking at the asset base of a business and treating so much of the innovation challenges. How do I create new value from existing assets? In the Samsung case I showed, there was no new technology. There was just their existing LCD manufacturing capability, and along came a proposition that could create entirely new value out of it. And out of that project, four or five new businesses like that came out of it. So that orientation of starting with understanding the asset base, what's flexible about it? There's a whole chapter on flexing existing assets in the book that gets at this. And I think as innovators, we have a responsibility to look at the existing asset base not as this constraint or this archaic thing of the past, but as the canvas that we're going to paint on. If Da Vinci had said rectangles of canvas are way too big a constraint for me to work on, you know, we wouldn't have the Mona Lisa. You know, not that there's a miracle waiting for everything. There are some things that are just structurally on the wrong side of history. But it's amazing how often if you take that orientation to how do I treat these assets as canvas to paint new value on, that something big won't emerge from it.
As an innovation company, did you purposely choose as part of your company name a unit of temperature that the UK voted out of date in 1971?
Absolutely. That was absolutely fundamental to it. We're in the transformation business, and of all the transformations that go on in science or human experience, the leap of water from Celsius 99 to 100 unleashes one of the most powerful transformations that has changed our world. That's what made the steam trains run. When we flick the light switch, the truth is even nuclear power plants are just giant tea kettles, and it's the boiling of water that makes all these things happen, and that's what makes coffee beans worth caring about. And you know, as for Celsius, 100 is just too boring a number, and Fahrenheit, nobody knows how to spell it. So that, you know, why we did that, I don't know. But anyway, it just sounded more interesting. In opening in London last year, we debated. So do we call that Celsius 100? But the number 100 is just too perfect to be interesting, you know.
Very full answer to a flippant question, which is, so thank you for taking it so seriously.
Oh, we debated this.
Yeah. We've only got a few minutes left, so maybe if we just take a few questions, a few hands up, and then you can pick and choose. So if we, gentleman in the scarf, then in front, and then over here.
As important your vending machine is in innovation, where do you see a real game changer, following from the question earlier, that's going to change humankind's existence as electricity did, or where do you see the new game changer?
Two extremely quick questions. One is, how do you use the model back on your own business? And secondly, have there been any projects that were so good that a client didn't buy that you just wanted to spin out throughout the journey?
Okay, thank you. And then the final one, and then you can continue.
The model sort of it implies a roughly equal amount of effort put into both sides of the equation at once. But that can't possibly be the case, I would have thought. And can you sort of talk about where you put different emphases for different kinds of companies you're working with?
Mm. Really good questions.
Yeah, so I'll quickly take on all three. So there is no there's no one size fits all application of both sides to any given challenge, but you know, because sometimes the questions are immensely complex on one side or the other, and relatively simple on the other, but it's still the forcing together of these perspectives that, you know, two hands pushing on the clay. In a way that has made the difference. So, but the complexity of the challenge will drive, you know, what's required on each side of the ledger in any given case. Do we point the model on ourselves? Yes, not as often as we should. I think anyone in a business like ours, you get so excited by the blank page and the possibility in the client challenge that you can go months and months and months completely ignoring your own business because you're just so fixated on the interesting things you're doing. We try to force ourselves to go back every once in a while and do it. And there are some products we've built, service products that we have constructed as two-sided solutions. Why is it good for us? Why is it good for them? It's simple and it works. As for what's huge ahead of us, for me, it's just one. It's green energy. You know, the world falls apart if we don't. And the changes in distribution of prosperity that can come with that are tremendous. Affordable green energy, I think, is the one above all others that I would hold up as the next game changer, because you look at all the scenario planning of what life's like if that doesn't happen, and it's really bleak. You know, we wouldn't want to live in that world. So that's got an imperative to it.
Thank you, Mark. That was a great talk and some really good questions from the audience. Your book, I think, is out and back, and I'm sure you'll be stick around to sign some copies if you'd like to sign them. So the only thing left to do is to thank you once again, Mark Payne.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.